Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
We're going to be starting the book of Ezekiel today. And boy, it starts out with a bang, I want to tell you, as you well know. Let's do this. Let me give you a couple of good references. Let's do a basic outline to the book. Let's look briefly at the prophet himself and the historical circumstances. And then let's go headlong into Ezekiel's vision, okay? Now, there are three basic commentaries that I think are good that are out on Ezekiel. The first one is Ezekiel by John Taylor. It's put out by InterVarsity Press. I really like this whole series in the Old Testament. I trust all of them, just as I trust the New Testament series of Tyndale, put out by Erdmans, I believe. And so you'll like this. It's really good. It's small, but it's detailed and compact. Here's one I found called The Prophecy of Ezekiel by Finberg, and you may enjoy this. It's a little more... not quite as technical, though it has some very interesting points. And then finally, the pulpit commentary is very interesting in the Old Testament because it gives you a lot of rabbinical commentators and deals a lot in theories of the classical church fathers, and so it's very helpful. So those three will be helpful to you. Ezekiel is more structured than any other of the major prophets. Its prophecy falls in sequential order. It's obvious that it's outlined. It's very easy to follow. In chapters 1 through 3 is the initial call of Ezekiel. In chapters 4 through 24, he talks about the sinfulness of the Jewish people and the fall of Jerusalem. That is, he's going to predict the fall of Jerusalem. And then in 25 through 32, he talks about judgment on the nations that surround Palestine. And then in verses 33 through 37, after Jerusalem has fallen, before the word has gotten to the exiles, he begins to preach restoration, not only of God's city and God's temple, but God's people. And then in verses 38 and 39 is this apocalyptic invasion from the north, which is defeated. And then in 40 through 48 is the restored temple and city. And that's the basic outline. Now, he is a priest from the line of Zadok. Jeremiah was from the other line of Abathar. Ezekiel is a priest. He may have been studying for the priesthood. He was taken into exile in the first deportation in 597 B.C. You might want to see 2 Kings 24:14, which described 10,000 of the priests and the nobles and the princes of the land were taken into captivity. So as Jeremiah speaks to God's people in Palestine during this period of Babylonian dominance, Ezekiel speaks to God's people who are in exile, and Daniel, also taken in this deportation, is in Babylon itself, in the throne room of Nebuchadnezzar II is where he ministered. Now, we know he was married because his wife is going to die. He had his own home. I think chapter 1, verse 1, where it says in the 30th year is probably speaking of his age and not something else. And so that's the kind of man we have. He's a very unusual man, whether it's because God told him to do some of these strange things or because he already had this natural bent, I don't know. But he's not the kind of guy you want to live next door to, I promise you that. He's just a little wild. The book of Ezekiel is a beautiful book. It scares a lot of people because it's got so much apocalyptic symbolism. But it's got a tremendous message, a message of God's sovereignty. And also, it focuses in on the new covenant of Jeremiah in the sense of individual responsibility. And we're going to see that in these opening chapters, and especially in chapters 18 and 33. So this is the focal point of the prophet. He sees judgment, but he sees hope and restoration to a remnant, and he sees the sovereignty of God and individual responsibility. Now, with that in mind, let's go, if we could, to the book itself. Notice it says, now it came about in the 30th year, I think, that refers again to the age of the prophet, because verses 2 and 3 are going to lock it into the date of the exiled Davidic king. In the fifth day of the fourth month. Now, there is a lot of dating in this book. Ezekiel really makes an effort to date his prophecies. Chapter 1, verses 1 and 2, chapter 8, verse 1, chapter 20, verse 1, chapter 24, verse 1, 26, 1, 29, 1, 30, verse 20, 31, 1, 32 verses 1 and 17, 33, 21, 40 verse 1, all have extensive dating. And they go in a flow. Now, the only dates that are out of sync are this little section on the judgments to the surrounding nations. But everything else is in chronological, sequential order. Notice it says, I was by the river Kibar. Now, this is near the city of Dnieper. It was a man-made canal from the Euphrates River that helped fertilize part of this farming region. It's called the Great Canal in Babylonian documents, okay? You might want to see Psalms 137:1. Among the exiles, and that's where Ezekiel's ministry was, to those who had already been exiled and those who would be exiled after the fall of Jerusalem in 586 B.C. The heavens were open. This is the only place in the Old Testament this phrase is used. Used quite often in the New Testament, once in Matthew at Jesus' baptism, used of John on the Isle of Patmos. The heavens were open, and I saw visions of God. Now, there's been a strange paradox in the Old Testament between those who say they saw God and those that say you can't see God and live. Let me give you the paradox, if I could. In Exodus 24, 10 and 11, it seems the elders saw God. In Numbers 12, 8, the same assertion is made. In Isaiah 6 and Revelation 4, it seems they saw God. But other passages say you can't see God and live. Exodus 33, 20 through 23. John 1, 18 and John 6, 46. 1 Timothy 6, 16 and 1 John 4, 12. Well, I think what it's saying is that these men saw something of a human form, maybe the pre-incarnate Jesus. Maybe they just were expecting God to be in human form and they saw it that way. I'm not sure. But they saw something. It was so bright and dazzling. They never look at the person's face. They look at his feet, or they look at the throne that he's on. And so it's kind of like they could see God, kind of, but never looked intently or gazed upon him. That seems to be the distinction here. Now it says, everything in Ezekiel, by the way, is first person except verses 2 and 3 of chapter 1. This seems to be an editorial insertion to explain verse 1. Now, the Jewish rabbis say that the book of Ezekiel was written by Ezra and the men of the great synagogue. And what they mean by that is that he edited it. Now, I think Ezra fits probably a more central role in our Old Testament formation than we as Christians understand. The Jews have always had a tradition that Ezra is the one that edited the Old Testament in its current form. Now, notice verse 2 what it says. On the fifth of the month of the fifth year of King Jehoiakim's exile. Now, the date of this is about 592-593. That's the date. So, he's 30 years old, and that's the date. He's about 25 years old now, if you compare the dates of verse 1 and 2. He's about 25 when he was taken to captivity. He's 30 now. You might want to see 2 Kings 24:14, where this is described, okay? The word of the Lord came expressly to Ezekiel the priest, son of Buzi. Now, he was a priest of the line of Zadok. He probably had been trained in the priesthood. He probably never was able to minister there. This 30 years old is interesting. It's used in several passages in the Old Testament for the age when a priest began to minister in the temple. It's quite possible that Ezekiel had trained for the priesthood, and the captivity thwarted that. And he sees this as his beginning of ministry in a real sense. Now, some places where this 30-year-old is used for the beginning of the priest is Numbers 4, verses 23, 30, 39, 43, and 47. Okay? In the land of the Chaldeans. Now, here it means the Babylonians, the Neo-Babylonians. The word Chaldean can mean a language group. It can mean a racial group, or it can mean a group of wise men. And Daniel's called a Chaldean. So it depends on what part of the scripture it's in, to which one of those three it may mean. By the river Kibar, and there the hand of the Lord came upon me. Well, this is an anthropomorphic phrase, for God does not have a body. God is spirit. Sometimes the angel of the Lord, which I believe is probably the pre-incarnate Christ, appears in a human form, whether it be the angels that appeared to Abraham, or he saw God on the throne. That must be the Son, for that's the only part of the Trinity that has an incarnate body. I think this is a word that speaks of God's power and inspiration and equipment and presence on someone. It's used throughout the book of Ezekiel. There are many phrases that Ezekiel uses over and 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 over again. It seems very repetitive to us, but in its day, it was very important as far as memorizing it and getting the message across. It's perfectly literary technique of its day. It seems very repetitive to us. And as I looked, behold, a storm was coming from the north. Now, of course, God is often identified with a storm. It seems to be that the storm was what it looked like when God came down on Mount Sinai. Now, throughout this chapter, it says it looked like. Ezekiel is trying in human language to capture that which is above human language. So he says it looked like a storm, a thunderstorm, a lot of lightning, dark clouds coming from the north. The north is always the symbol of judgment. You might want to see, let's see here, Jeremiah 1, 13 and 14. It becomes a symbol of judgment or problems or pain. Now, from the north, coming into Palestine, that was the only way to enter Palestine from that direction because of the desert. And that's where the idea came from. It was the way the invading armies always came, except for Egypt, of course, which came through the south. Great cloud flashing forth continually, as brilliant light around it, in the midst something like glowing metal. Now, King James has amber, and Revised Standard has bronze. But really, it's something like a gleaming metal. I heard many people say it was like a mixture of gold and silver shining in the sun. Something like that, in the midst of the fire. And within it were figures presenting four living beings. Now, the living is the emphasis here. Now, these are strange beings. I don't have all to say about them. They seem to be almost a combination between seraphim and cherubim. They seem to be a third kind. They're described differently. The cherubim in Exodus 25:20, has only one face, and it faces the center of the mercy seat. But these seem like cherubs because they're almost the same as the four living creatures of Revelation 4. And if they're going to have four faces, the number of wings varies some. It's a pretty wild deal. Some people say it symbolizes the major groups of God, different order of creation, man and beast and domestic beast and birds, but I'm not sure of all that. It's just a pretty wild deal. It shows the presence of God and His ministers. Now, and their appearance had human form. They had four faces. Now, in Revelation 4:7, there are four of them, with each with a different face, just like every one of them had four faces. And apparently, they're on four corners of a chariot kind of thing, and in any direction, you could see each one of the faces because of the way it was turned. So they were all the same, but because you looked at them a different way, you could see four different ones. And their legs were straight, and their feet were like a calf's hooves, and they gleamed like burnished bronze. That's used twice in the letters to the churches in Revelation to describe something that John saw. And under their wings, their four sides, were human hands able to manipulate, move. And their faces and wings were four of them, okay? Now, quite often, these have tried to have been described. Notice that in verse 10 it says that one of a lion and one of an ox and one of a man and one of an eagle. Well, the early church fathers took this as a representation of the different gospels. They would say Matthew's the lion, Mark is the ox, Luke is the man, and John's the eagle. But I don't know where they get that from. We just don't know what this is, to tell you the truth. It's just a great vision of the holiness of God. It's repeated in chapter 10 and described more. Let's see. And each went straight for wherever the Spirit was about to go. Now, the Spirit here is not capitalized. Look at that in verse 20 and 21. It seems to be the spirit of the beings, although it could be the Spirit of God that moved them. But they moved simultaneously. They didn't move, but they could move like this. And they all moved together. Everything moved in a unity. Okay? In the midst of this, now let me just give you a mental picture. There's going to be a flat platform, maybe domed, with a throne on top. And it's going to be one of these creatures at the four corners with their wings touching, like this, making a box around that. In the middle of this hollow box is the coals of fire, like off the altar. They were some kind of coals that burned. Same thing that Isaiah saw when he saw the Lord high and lifted up. It may have been a symbol of God taking the holiness when He left the temple. For it talks about God leaving the temple and moving to the exile because the temple had become so perverted. So it's a hollow box made with two of these wings on each of the corners. And on top is a surface. It's called a firmament here. Let me see if I can find it. Look at verse 16. Let me get the wheels. Getting so excited. I can see this myself. Next to the living creatures, four of them, were these wheels. And they were right beside each of these creatures. And they touched the earth, though the creatures didn't. And the wheel was seen to be a large wheel. Around the edge were eyes. And then perpendicular to it was another wheel. So it'd be two wheels, but perpendicular, showing movement any direction. And it's like a chariot. Matter of fact, the rabbis call this the chariot of God. And they get it from 1 Chronicles 28:18. And so it's going to lift all the earth, lift up off the earth, which shows the wheels weren't necessary for the mobility. And so, boy, it was an impressive thing, I want to tell you. The appearance of the wheels and their workmanship was like sparkling beryl. Now, all these different crystallite and beryl and amber, we don't know what these ancient metals and ancient jewels were. The names change from country to country and age to age. So it's just speculation what they really were. We just can't lock it down with any certainty. Notice in verse 18 there had eyes all around these wheels, which I think symbolized the presence of God. Notice it says it rose from the earth and the wheels also in verse 19. There's the mobility. Look at verse 22. Now over the heads of the living beings there was something like an expanse. Now this Hebrew word means something that is hammered out. It's used of the dome of the sky. And some think because of the color here, it may have been like ice, like blue ice or crystal. And on top of this where God's throne is. Now this same word is used in Genesis 1:6. It's used in Psalms 19:1. It's an awesome thing. It's that firmament. We would call it the dome of the sky. But it's seen several times as the presence of God, an expanse, a domed expanse is the idea here. Okay? Now let's see, Exodus 24:10, this same thing is seen. Or maybe like for the color, you might want to see Revelation 4:6. The crystal sea of John's vision on Patmos is probably very close to what Ezekiel saw here. And he heard a voice of their wings, like the sound of the abundant waters as they went, like the voice of the Almighty. This is the patriarchal name for God, El Shaddai. God is not known by Yahweh until revealed to Moses in Exodus 3:14. And so he was called El, which is the general name for God, El Shaddai, God Almighty, and only later, Yahweh. Now, the word Jehovah is a made-up word. It comes from taking the vowels from Adonai, or Lord, and inserting them in the consonants for Yahweh. The Jews were afraid to pronounce the covenant name for God, and the Germans were the first to do word studies. They had no Y. All the J's in your Bible are Y's. Jerusalem, Yeshua, Yahweh. But the Germans put a J there, Jerusalem, Jehovah. I think if we call God Jehovah, he says, huh, who? Now, notice it, let's see. Let me read the last part of this. Now, above the expanse that was over their heads, there was something resembling a throne. Now, the rabbis call this the throne chariot of God. Now, I hope you catch it in your mind. It moved out of the thunderstorm, a symbol of the presence of God, lightning, holiness, these angelic creatures like the seraphim of Isaiah, or the cherubim on the Ark of the Covenant, or the four living beasts in the book of the Revelation chapter 4, symbolize the presence and holiness of God. And here is the holiness of God that's up in the heavens, but he's come to earth. Now, the ideal of a chariot was probably what they expected him to see because the chariots of their day. I don't know if we'd expect God in a Rolls Royce today or what. I think some of these metaphors are culturally conditioned and not universally true. I think God accommodated himself to what they expected in their day. For he surely couldn't appear in a Learjet to Ezekiel. He wouldn't know how to describe that. So I think that some of this is cultural, but the reality is certainly here, and that is the awesomeness and the holiness of the presence of God who is going to touch Ezekiel and say, friend, I want you. I want you to minister for me. I've got a message to tell these folks, and you're the one I've told to do it. You know, the call of Isaiah, and although it's not recorded in Jeremiah so much, maybe he had a tremendous vision. These are dramatic things where God picked these men out, like Moses, and said, showed them a tremendous vision of his glory, majesty, and power, and said, I want you. Now, poor Ezekiel didn't have a chance to gripe. God says, it's you, friend. I think he would have if he had a chance. He just didn't. Throne like Lapis Lazuli. Now, here again is a stone. The name's very popular. We're not sure exactly what it is. It seems to mean a lot of people put sapphire here, the blueness, the crystalness of it, as a symbol of the sky, and it's become a symbol of purity. We just don't know. On that which resembled a throne, high up was a figure in the appearance of a man. Now, this appearance of a man is not unusual. Daniel's going to see the Ancient of Days as the appearance of a human form. The angel that talked with Lot with Abraham concerning Lot, had human form. I really think we're talking about the angel of the Lord, which I think is the pre-incarnate Christ. This is not saying that the image of God in man is man's human form. I think Mormonism has gone far beyond biblical guidelines in asserting the physicalness of God. God is spirit, and the only part of the Trinity that has a corporal existence is Jesus. And we need to remember that, or be careful of these anthropomorphic phrases, taking them too literally. Then I notice, from the appearance of his loins and upward, something like glowing metal. Ezekiel was afraid to look at his face, as Isaiah was afraid to look at the face of the man on the throne. He saw the throne. He saw his feet. He saw the smoke fill the temple. That was all. Now, glowing metal. There's that same word again. We would think shining, glittering metal. It looked like fire all around it. And from the appearance of his loins and downward, I saw something like fire. And there was a radiance around him as the appearance of a rainbow. Well, the rainbow was a symbol to them, as well as to us, of the promise not to destroy the earth again by flood back in Noah's day. And so it is a symbol of the mercy and grace of God. We're going to see it in Revelation 4:3. It's totally surrounded the throne. Now, the book of the Revelation, which has been so controversial, pulls symbols. It never quotes. Isn't it funny the book of Ezekiel is never quoted in the Old Testament or in the New Testament one time? Although the book of the Revelation pulls a lot of its imagery from the book of Ezekiel, the book of Daniel, and the book of Zechariah. Those are the three main sources of the imagery of the book of the Revelation. And when you read through here, it's obvious that John is going back to this over and over again. The rainbow, the crystal sea, and all of that kind of thing as he saw God. A rainbow in the clouds on a rainy day. So it was the appearance of the surrounding radiance. Such was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. Now, all the way through here, if you'll go back and underline the word likeness, you'll have made, I think it's 9 times it's used in the first chapter. Why that? Well, Ezekiel can't give in detail what he had never seen before. There weren't words to convey. How do you talk about the glory of God? How do you talk about the crystal sea? How do you talk about creatures who are so wild that you've never seen like it? Some say, well, these are just creatures that he had seen in Assyrian and Babylonian art. They're different from anything there. I agree, winged animals are part of the decorum of the Babylonian and Assyrian temples. I agree with that. But nothing like the human hands and the human form. Nothing like the four different faces. So there's real uniqueness. And I don't think we can just say Ezekiel was dreaming here and he just saw Babylonian art. I don't think that's true at all. The likeness of the glory of the Lord. Now, the glory of the Lord, when the rabbis want to talk about the glory of the Lord, they usually think about the Shekinah cloud of glory. For in the midst of it is the fire, and yet it's hidden. And there's this twin paradox. And it's true in our lives as well as in God's physical presence. God is holy. And sinful man cannot contact the holy without great danger to himself. But God still comes to us. But when he comes to us, he covers that glory, be it with a cloud or whatever, so that we can know him and be with him and yet not be afraid of being overcome. So that's the idea here, I think. The glory of the Lord. And I saw it, and I fell on my face, and I heard a voice speaking. Well, now, falling on your face is a position of reverence and awe and respect. I'm surprised Ezekiel lasted as long as he did standing up with this kind of might. Apparently, Ezekiel was by himself. Now, this vision is going to be somewhat referred to over and over and over again throughout the book. He's going to continue to say, this is something really wild that set my stage. Now, I want to mention to you that what we have here is the call of Ezekiel and the pattern in next few verses of what Ezekiel is going to do throughout the book. Ezekiel seems to be a combination of dramatic action and spoken prophecy. And it's going to be some pretty bizarre stuff. But God seems to tell him at every stage what he wants him to do. He's going to be quiet at periods and do symbolic action. He's going to speak at other periods. And it's just going to have to be something that God reveals moment by moment. This vision, I wish I knew more it was about. I read a lot of commentaries on it. Nobody can explain this. Nobody knows what it is. It's a sui generis kind of thing. There's nothing to relate it to except maybe the call of Isaiah or John's deal on Patmos. It's just beyond human vocabulary. And we have to be satisfied with the main thrust, and that is the Holy God came to Ezekiel because even though the people had sinned, He still loved them. And though they were in exile because of their idolatry, God wanted them to know, first of all, how serious their sin was, and that what He was going to do to punish their sin, and then that He hadn't forgot them, that the covenant was still intact, even though the temple was destroyed. He's going to restore the temple. His presence is with them. He still cares for them. He's still going to provide for their needs, even in the midst of their rebellion. And the symbol of that is He chooses one of them and calls him out to be His spokesman. Now, I think that's a tremendous word. And I think the awesomeness of what God is like says something of His transcendence. And yet, the fact that this awesomeness was by the river Kibar in exile was extremely significant to these Jews. They felt like God lived at the temple, that the Ark of the Covenant was the feet of His footstool rested there. Well, here He is in His mobile chariot, and He's gone all the way to Babylon to say, I haven't left you, friend. I'm with you. I care about you. Sin is significant. It will destroy you. It'll rob our fellowship. But I'm here with you, and I love you, and I'm going to provide for you. And so here we have the idea of God not being a local deity attached to some geographical location. Well, that was tremendously important to see. This chapter, I think, I just wish I could understand more about it. I wish I could get in my mind a picture of it. But I think the best thing for me is this hollow box made by these angelic creatures' wings with the coals of fire in the middle, and on top this covered dome-like dish of clear as crystal glass with a throne on top and the semblance of a human being. Now, that's about as far as I can go. I hope you'll read all that you have on this. I think it says some beautiful things to us. I've really enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.